Well, hello again, everyone. It is Thursday, April the 14th, and this is your weekly Access to Access webinar. As you know, as a Vault subscriber, this is something we do every week on the GoToWebinar platform so that you, the listener, get a chance to interact and ask questions of the guest. And today's guest is a good one, a guy I've gotten to know over the last couple of years by the name of John Butler. John is an American werewolf in London. That's a good way to describe you, right, John?
Well, I guess so. Not sure about the werewolf part, but the London part for sure.
Longtime money manager, now known as an author of a fabulous book that came out a couple years ago, and I would encourage everyone to read it, as it's just as relevant today as it was when it came out. Book's called The Golden Revolution, with the subtitle, How to Prepare for the Coming Global Gold Standard. He's a sound money proponent, renowned worldwide, and now he works for Gold Money with the combination Gold Money BitGold, where he is the vice president and head of wealth services. John, with that introduction, thank you for spending some time with us here at Turdville.
My pleasure, Craig.
All right, I want to dive right in, my friend. There's a lot to cover and a lot going on today. But again, I want to begin with kind of an update on BitGold and the gold money combination, and what, how things are going there, and the value and what this service does for everybody. Because one, I think it's wonderful. Everybody here on the site knows I've endorsed it ever since I first heard about it last summer. They're advertisers and sponsors of TFMR, and I encourage everybody to take a look at it, because gosh, why continue to save in devaluing and constantly devaluing fiat currency when you could save in gold instead? John, give everybody an update, please, on how things are going and the targets that you're meeting and the growth that you're seeing.
Well, thank you. Yes, look, growth is astonishingly rapid. We've surprised even ourselves in what is nearly our first year of existence as a startup firm, that is the BitGold firm that started up in Toronto. We've got over 800,000 client signups now for the BitGold business, and that's a huge number. Now, most of those signups are small, but simply getting anyone to do anything online in this day and age, there's a lot of competition for that. There's a lot of competition for people's time and attention. And that we've managed to get 800,000 people to go through the trouble, as it were, of opening a BitGold account, we regard as a huge success. And the amount we've had to spend to acquire those clients has been very, very low if you benchmark us to successful e-commerce firms. Take PayPal, for example, or other firms that have established a service purely online, and they've gone after sort of building a network for that service. Our client acquisition cost and rate compare extraordinarily favorably within this industry. And you know, what explains that? I mean, is it that we're just much better at marketing ourselves? I think there are some clever people who have been involved in crafting our marketing campaign, so let's give them some credit where it's due. But actually, I think it comes down to gold. I think that there is a broader awakening now with a younger generation that is coming of age within what they clearly regard as a dysfunctional banking system. And when presented with a non-bank opportunity to nevertheless access a proper store of value, mm-hmm. even if in a small amount, and for that, you know, gold savings account, if you want to call it that, for that to also be potentially the basis for transfers on the network, for payments to merchants on the network, or outside of the network, if the network does not include who it is you're trying to transact with, all of that and the whole mentality that goes with it, I think maybe it's simply explained by, you know, these millennials who are waking up to gold as a very credible, practical, and using our technology, convenient and low cost way to base, if not all, at least part of your financial life and livelihood on gold.
It's tremendous, and it's helping all of us that just frankly just want a fair system and want to see the banks get out of this fractional reserve bullion banking and the paper derivative pricing scheme. All of this gold that BitGold and Gold Money takes in is fully allocated, right, and taken out of that system.
Yes, it's fully allocated. We don't lend any gold out. There is no point during a client's time on the platform when their gold is not 100% fully reserved, stored in a Brink's vault. If you're a Bitgold client, if you're a gold money client, you get greater choice in your vaulting arrangements. But for Bitgold, it's always a Brink's vault. It's always insured by a Lloyd's of London syndicate, and the gold is audited on a quarterly basis by KPMG, who literally will stand next to us as we go by and count the bars. Also, the ledger of who owns what exactly is updated more than once a day and is provided in physical form. That is, it's actually printed out physically at every vaulting location. So, you know, God forbid, I mean, I don't think this is going to happen, but, you know, God forbid something happens to us as a firm and we can't operate for some reason, number one. Number two, something happens to the internet and e-commerce in general suffers some massive problem, and people can't access information properly online. There is this fail-safe chain of custody between our clients and the gold, and literally, the vault will know. The vault will know what belongs to, you know, what belongs to whom, and it will get sorted out in the end. So, I mean, look, I certainly hope none of those things happen, but we have set up our infrastructure to be robust to literally every conceivable scenario for potential disruption, and I believe it's a far more solid chain of custody than what you'll get to even a bank account in this day and age. And of course, we know that bank accounts are themselves subject to credit risk, to valuation risk, bail-in risk, depending on your jurisdiction. So this is a far more robust infrastructure that we're building.
I can't give it a bigger thumbs up. The other piece of the puzzle that I've always thought was just going to be huge, especially when it's implemented here in the US, is the ability to then use your Bitgold account to buy stuff. To get a debit card and go to the grocery store, fill up your gas tank or whatever out of this, what is it basically like a traditional checking or savings account, only the basis of the account is gold. What's the status of that, John, for acceptance and use around the world, but in Canada, in Europe, and then mainly in the US as well? How are things looking?
Yes, from a they're looking good. I mean, there are challenges involved in doing this. Now, from a regulatory perspective, the gold custody service, that is the gold savings account, as it were, that we provide, that has a relatively light touch from a regulatory perspective. It's when you start to build out the payment side that the regulators get more involved, because obviously they're concerned about fraudulent transactions, money laundering, criminal use of the network, whatever it is, okay? And so they want to make absolutely certain that we maintain proper records, that we can produce those records if required by the authorities due to, you know, whatever it is, legal action or investigations, basically the same way a bank is required to do so. Now, as we know, banks are abused for all kinds of criminal activities and money laundering and everything else. So there's no guarantee, you know, one way or the other, but the fact is the regulators nevertheless require you to jump through a lot more hoops if you're doing more than simply offering savings. And in the US, it's doubly complicated, because every state kind of has its own variations on those regulations. And so the way you need to approach rolling out the payments in the US, you literally need to be proceeding state by state. Now, we have initiated those discussions. They are taking place. Once a few states sign on, the other ones will use that as precedent, and it will solve itself at an exponential rate, right? That's the good news. And we are generating some momentum there. And the thing about the payments is, I suspect a lot of people who are going to be listening to this discussion today, they're going to think, wait a minute, why would I spend my gold? Gold's undervalued. Yeah, I know it's undervalued. I think it's going to $5,000, $10,000, some combination of gold going up, the dollar going down, so on and so forth. And I don't disagree with that. You're well aware that I believe that gold in dollar terms is very, very undervalued, you know, an order of magnitude undervalued. So I would not be inclined to spend my gold either. But that's a luxury that I happen to have, because I'm at an age where I've been able to save quite a bit of money, and I can save a lot of that in gold now, and I can, you know, spend in local currency as I need to for whatever expenses I have as I go along. So I choose not to spend my gold. But what about the younger person? What about someone who's starting out in life, who does not trust the banks, and they have every reason not to trust the banks? They've accumulated only a little bit of savings. They want to protect the value of that savings. Well, okay, isn't it at least nice to provide these people, these younger people with less savings, a way to nevertheless save in gold, and if they need to liquidate the gold to make the down payment on a house, to purchase a new car, something big like that, or an unexpected, emergency expense of some kind, health issue, who knows what it is, by making it low cost and convenient and relatively frictionless to spend your gold, we're actually democratizing access to gold. We're allowing gold to be used by this whole demographic that previously would have seen it as too expensive, too cumbersome, and so on and so forth. But we're changing that now. So don't get me wrong. Yes, I think gold's undervalued, but if you feel you have to buy a house, isn't it nice to know that you can cash out your gold savings for very, very low transactions fees and move that money to where it needs to be to put that down payment on the house? This is the technology we have, and this is how we see it helping people, not just wealthy people, but if anything, disproportionately helping the relatively less wealthy with gold. That's kind of part of our core vision.
Yeah. And again, more awareness of gold in general and how gold is money and fiat is just currency. I mean, all of that, it just helps the home team in the end. And so I think it's tremendous, and I just want to do everything I can to help your business grow. John, I want to start moving toward the question part of the show. And again, for anybody listening, if you have a question for John, there is a tab in your GoToWebinar control panel for questions. You click that tab, you type in the question, and I relay it to John after I get to ask him my own questions. So John, if I might just dive right in, I'll try to abbreviate and shorten this question as much as I can, but if you're ready, I'd like to lay one on you.
Yes, please, by all means.
I'm holding in my grubby little hands my copy of The Golden Revolution, and I don't recommend books here unless I've actually read it, and I just, for anybody that doesn't have it, there'll be a link on this podcast page. If you don't own it, you should. I'm looking at page 98, and on this page, you mention how back when the Soviet Union was falling apart in the late 80s, two prominent U.S. economists, Wayne Angel and Jude Wanniski, traveled to St. Petersburg to meet with Soviet economic and financial officials and encourage them to consider backing the devaluing ruble with their gold reserves. Now, that was obviously 20, 30 years ago. I'm wondering if maybe that idea didn't stick. And so here we are now in 2016. We've got all this talk about how much gold the Chinese actually have. And we've got all this infrastructure sent up, from the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, the BRICS Bank, all the different swap facilities with the yuan. We had all these different things that have now taken place in the last 30 years. Kind of bring us up to date. What do you think ultimately is the end game for gold in the global financial system? Are we headed back in that direction?
Well, I think gold is being kind of de facto monetized behind the scenes. Whether that ever gains informal international recognition the way, say, Bretton Woods was a formal international monetary convention, that's a more open question. But the idea that gold is going to find multiple monetary uses again going forward, I think the evidence of this is just overwhelming at this point. And Russia is a great example of a country that you could argue it would be in the national interest of Russia under certain scenarios to indeed heed the advice of Wayne Angel and Jude Wanniski and consider, if not linking the ruble to gold necessarily, at a minimum possibly linking future bond issues to gold. Because one problem the Russian economy's had with all the volatility in oil prices, the sanction issues which were raised around Ukraine and which may escalate further in future depending on what happens in that country. The thing is this, is that all that instability led to very high domestic interest rates in Russia, double-digit interest rates, the sort of level of interest rates that tends to cause a recession. And sure enough, the Russian economy is much weaker today than it was 3 or 4 years ago as a result. But one of the simplest ways in the world, of course, to bring interest rates down is to bring credibility for the currency, for the bonds, up. And if Russia, for example, issued a bond that where the coupons and the principal would in fact be payable in gold, or you'd have the option to receive them in rubles, but say linked to the gold price at time of maturity, You know, what interest rate would people demand for gold-backed Russian bonds? Yeah. They demand a far lower interest rate than unbacked bonds. And indeed, of course, a full gold standard would bring interest rates crashing down to, to its credible, a properly credible gold standard, interest rates could be brought down, you know, 1, 2, 3% or something like that, representing simply the pure time value of money rather than any real credit risk. Russia has the luxury of being able to contemplate these sorts of actions to stabilize their financial system and their economy because they have the gold. They've got loads of it. Relative to their money supply, Russia can literally back half their narrow money supply with gold outright, half of it. That's a huge amount of gold. If they wanted to back their bond issues with gold, they've got even better coverage ratios to pay coupons and principal on government bonds in gold for subsequent bond issues. So, you know, this is very credible. And, of course, Russia also has gold in the ground, right? They're one of the world's largest gold producers. And Russia's a huge net exporter. So, in theory, they're always accumulating foreign assets and can swap some of those foreign assets into physical gold should they choose to do so. So Russia's holding a lot of gold cards they can play. And I'd be surprised if things continue to escalate in some of the disputes between Russia and the West and or Russia's economy encounters further difficulties, I'd be surprised if they didn't find a use for gold in some way, perhaps along the lines I've described. But then think about any large exporting nation that's still accumulating a bunch of fiat paper, that's still accumulating bonds, say U.S. Treasury bonds, that pay almost no interest. And in fact, in many cases now, interest on government bonds is zero or negative, such as in the euro area. Well, look, I mean, the opportunity cost of reducing your paper reserves in favor of physical gold is zero. And there's no reason why, in that sort of environment, governments will not continue around the world, especially for exporting countries, will continue to swap some of their foreign asset proceeds for physical gold. We see it happening. If anything, it's accelerating. China are very cagey about their numbers. Many people think they have three or four times as much official gold as they let on. So all of this argues for additional monetary uses for gold at a minimum at the official level and international level, possibly even at the national level, depending on the country. I see this is where we're going. These are the trends.
I guess then my follow-up question to that is there's a section in your book that talks about, you know, what happens. You wake up one morning and the news on Bloomberg or wherever is that Russia or China or some combination of the two or whatever has suddenly announced to the world an alternative that is a partially gold-backed, hard asset-backed currency, an alternative to the dollar. How would you see that playing out, John? What's the first thing that comes to mind if you sit down one morning and all of a sudden that's the headline on financial TV?
Well, I mean, that really would be historic. In some ways, it would be kind of the mirror image of Nixon closing the gold window. If some other country came out and opened their gold window, saying, "Hey, henceforth, our currency is convertible into gold, and we will honor that at whatever, you know, whatever pegged price." Now, you know, in an age of currency wars, where it seems most countries prefer a weaker rather than stronger currency, it might be questionable. Why would anyone choose to do that? Doesn't everyone want a weak currency? Beyond a point, you don't. And especially if you're a huge net exporter and you're hugely competitive economically anyway, you can absorb some currency strength, and it will help to actually rebalance your economy. It will make your domestic consumers better off because it will increase the purchasing power of their accumulated savings.
Right.
And so a bit of rebalancing from exports to consumption is not a bad thing. You know, always trying to export rather than import, that reduces to mercantilism. And Adam Smith demonstrated in his magnum opus that mercantilism was not, in fact, the way to maximum prosperity, but rather a more balanced economy. So there are countries out there that would be willing to tolerate some currency strength. And if they're accumulating lots of foreign assets because they're competitive net exporters, well, then they also want to continue diversifying the gold. So I actually think moving forward in this, you know, twilight zone of zero or even negative interest rates, I actually think that the number of countries out there that will begin to see at least some sort of use for gold, backing bonds, backing the currency, backing both, I think that number of countries is growing. And I think that also as Keynesian economic management, aggregate demand management, becomes even further discredited as a result of the series of failures we've seen of that policy now in Japan, in Europe, in the United States, just about anywhere it's applied. Also, the world is watching, and the world someday is going to realize that this Keynesian model is simply flawed, is not valid. And once you throw those equations out and take a fresh look at things, guess what? You actually come around pretty quickly, I would argue, to the view that sound money and sound government finances actually make a lot of economic sense and increase your power in the world as a country. You know, it's simply no historical coincidence that every rise of every major power has coincided with that major power being on a sound money standard, usually gold or silver. There is not a single exception to this rule historically. And you can bet you Putin gets it. You can bet you the Chinese leadership get it. And I actually think that some of your sort of swing states in the world, like Germany, for example, that's behaving in an increasingly neutral way, I think they get it too.
Yeah. India, some of the other BRICS. You're absolutely right. I wonder if we shouldn't, since we wonder about the education level of some of the people coming up these days, what if we should instead start calling it Krugmanian instead of Keynesian? You know, at least we'd have a face that everybody recognizes to attach to it.
Well, I mean, actually, it's funny because Keynes' face is actually pretty recognized because he's such a prominent historical figure. The guy was present at Bretton Woods. You know, he was present during the World Wars, advising the British government. His face is actually pretty recognized. The thing is, though, is that even Keynes, if Keynes were alive today, I mean, he would take a look at what is being done in his name, and he would freak out. I don't agree with Keynes. I'm not really defending Keynes here. What I am doing is simply illustrating that what's being done in his name is kind of like Keynes on steroids now. And I think he probably would look around and say, oh my God, I would never have intended for you guys to go there. I kind of think that would be his reaction based on my own understanding of him and what he wrote and the sorts of policies he advocated. I think that this discrediting, Krugman does kind of play a role in the sense that he makes it so bleedingly obvious how ludicrous a lot of these policies are. He's obviously the darling of the Keynesian left in the United States. But he's had a real falling out with kind of some of the old guard in the U.S. who still believe that even after the gold window was closed by Nixon, there had to be at least some monetary sense. And there are lots of signs that, for example, Paul Volcker and Paul Krugman had a huge falling out a few years back, and it resulted on Krugman getting fired from Princeton.
I didn't realize that.
Well, it's not official, right? Things like this are never done in an official way, but
I suppose, yeah.
Volcker made some very disparaging comments regarding Krugman. Implicit, he didn't use his name. When he was lecturing at Princeton, Volcker was a guest lecturer, and apparently Krugman got very upset about it, and one thing led to another, and Krugman's no longer at Princeton; he's gone. So I'm not sure exactly what happened.
Doesn't Volcker realize that Krugman won a Nobel Prize, for crying out loud? Give me a break.
Well, the thing is, though, is that Krugman's Nobel Prize is for a completely different area of economics. It has nothing specifically to do with money, sound money or government finances. And in fact, it was very innovative for the time. It had to do with the economics of sort of clustering, why sort of the network effects that you generate by similar types of firms choosing to operate in similar locations to one another because they benefit from the same infrastructure, logistics, etc. It was more of a microeconomic thesis that Krugman gets the prize for, and less a Keynesian macroeconomic one. But that's what he's gone on to be very active in. And I think if anything, the guy is practically a spokesman for sound money anymore, because the stuff that comes out of his mouth is just crazy.
and longtime users of TFMR members and new members as well will recognize, of course, our motto: the end of the great Keynesian experiment is upon us. Prepare accordingly. For everybody listening, again, if you have a question for John, please type it in. I've got two of them in queue at present, and we'll see if anybody else has something that they want to expand upon. But I also want to be respectful of your time, because we're already about 25 minutes into this, John. Time goes fast. the first question from Tucent wants me to double back to China and the idea of whether China specifically, with all of this gold, and I've often said, you know, that China has to look at the 21st century and think, gosh, we'd sure like to have the power that the U.S. has had, you know, that exorbitant privilege of having the global reserve currency, or at least a reserve currency. So Tucent's question is, do you think China might head that way on their own? And under what timetable, if you do think that?
I think that's possible. That said, I think it is less likely that China acts completely unilaterally, and more likely that they will find partners with whom they make the great leap into the sort of monetary unknown, as it were, by remonetizing gold in some official way, either for explicit outright backing for the currency, or simply as they begin to demand gold settlement for their exports to cover the balance of payments vis-a-vis the rest of the world. So exactly how it happens, I don't know, but I would argue that China would seek partners. And in fact, look at the way China behaves in international economic matters generally. Leave the monetary thing aside for a moment. China is actually very, very good at building networks. They create the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. They create the Asian Investment and Infrastructure Bank. They create these institutions. They invite everyone who wants to participate sort of to the table, starting with a small group initially, but eventually broadening it out. China is all about building consensus. They're all about building long-term relationships. They literally will deal with almost anybody. And the same's kind of true of Russia. They'll deal with almost anybody on a given issue where they can agree. They don't need to have all or nothing relationships, which sadly is kind of the way the United States tends to operate anymore. And this consensus building, that to me is the way it would be done. If China is going to take the great leap, and that implies a potentially a stronger currency, which could harm their economy. The more countries make the great leap together at the same time, if they're trading with each other and they all move onto a sounder money regime in a challenge to the unsound regime, of course, that prevails today based around the dollar primarily, it's far less painful for any one country. Because you're trading largely with each other, and your net external debt position, your net external trade position, is much, much less, and so the economic disruption would be much, much less. So if China, if the bulk of Southeast Asia, if India, if Russia, and a handful of other countries were to all make that leap together, that would be far less disruptive for them, but of course it would place tremendous pressure on the United States to get their finances and their monetary policy under control, because who in their right mind is still going to finance these outrageous twin deficits in the U.S. At absurdly low interest rates if the rest of the world is backing their debt with gold? I mean, no one's going to buy unbacked treasuries at zero when they can buy gold-backed securities at 3%. So I think China will try to do it with a group. That's my guess. Exactly when, of course, I don't know. Exactly how, of course, I don't know. But whatever they do, I don't think it will be purely unilateral. That I'm pretty convinced of.
Yeah, you know, I talk a lot about how tomorrow's not going to be like yesterday, and how there's really no one left alive that lived in a world where the dollar wasn't the world's reserve currency. And so there's a great level of normalcy bias and cognitive dissonance, you know, to the idea that, wait a second, you mean there could be a time when the dollar wouldn't be? And so you really got to think outside the box.
This is why a history book is far more instructive today than an economics book, even a good economics book. The fact is, without historical perspective, you simply cannot make any sense at all out of what's going on. You really have to look at historical examples of countries rising and falling, their currencies rising and falling with them, the debasement that the debasement that occurs when a country declines. I mean, all of these things, are, you look at history and you have a far, far better sense of what's going on today. Now, that said, it can also be very intimidating because a lot of these historical periods are kind of nasty. And the 20th century itself was, you know, arguably the nastiest in history. Yep. It had all kinds of monetary regime change taking place. So, look, you know, it is what it is. This is the world we live in. And history does have a way of sorting these things out, hopefully with relatively less violence next time around.
But that is
where we're going. If it all blew up tomorrow, if the U.S. dollar came crashing down, if gold soared, whatever, nobody would look at that situation in retrospect and say, "Ah, the warning signs weren't there." Oh, come on! I mean, the warning signs are obvious. It's so obvious that that we have left any sense of equilibrium in the global economy. We've left it way, way behind. And any, you know, tipping points, phase transitions, choose your term, are all possible now. The timing is just uncertain.
Speaking of it all blowing up tomorrow, I do have a friend that believes that it is going to happen next week, as a matter of fact. And so we'll see if he's
That's
right.
That's quite a call.
It's like old Art Cashin always used to say, you know, you never want to go around predicting the end of the world because you're only going to be right once. So we'll see.
Very true.
All right, I've gotten a lot of questions that have stacked up, three or four here, wanting to just get your opinion on this news that broke overnight regarding Deutsche Bank and the settlement regarding their involvement in silver price manipulation, specifically at the FIX. Yep. But the key now is that they appear to be naming names and providing evidence of wrongdoing by their fellow conspirators. So anyway, just some thoughts from you on that.
Well, yes. First of all, I used to work at Deutsche Bank. That said, I did not work in the commodities trading division. I worked in macro asset allocation and investment strategy, and I did some product development, but I wasn't specifically working in the commodities division. However, Deutsche Bank is a besieged bank, right? They're being besieged by lawyers, regulators, and whatnot on all sides. The bank is in very serious trouble. They've settled all kinds of suits already for LIBOR manipulation and, you know, various other things, and now it's silver. So this is just the latest in a series of naughty activities, it seems, that Deutsche Bank had got up to at some point through the years. Now, in this case, it does refer to the FIX. What we're not talking about here is any evidence, at least not yet, that Deutsche Bank was, for example, systematically suppressing the price of silver for any prolonged period of time. No, this is just about a bit of intraday market manipulation where perhaps Deutsche was trying to get act on information before it was generally made public and was profiting by acting on that information. So, yes, that could have been distorting the silver market on an intraday basis, but there's no evidence yet that Deutsche Bank might have been participating in a general price suppression scheme, which is, as we know, something that many people think may be going on behind the scenes, and it may have been going on for years behind the scenes. That said, you never know what comes out of an investigation like this, and it could be that some interesting circumstantial, if not direct, evidence will come out of this. As you say, Deutsche Bank is expected now, as part of their settlement, to provide evidence of two-way communications with other banks that were also involved in the FIX. And so it would be astonishing to me if Deutsche Bank is the only one that is eventually implicated in this matter. It takes at least two to tango in something like this, and it could well be three or four or more banks were using the FIX in a way that favored their own trading desk and their own proprietary activities over the interests of their customers or counterparties. So watch this space. I don't think we've heard all of it yet. More may come out, but so far there's nothing to suggest that this relates to a general price suppression scheme. That's what's not yet being talked about here.
And we'll wait and see. I've had a couple of people tell me that they were encouraged to accept this settlement by BaFin, the big German securities regulator. So
Well,
if
they've
BaFin,
had it with Deutsche Bank. I mean, they've
yeah.
really lost patience with Deutsche Bank, right? I mean, here, this is your flagship bank. This is your face to the world. And Deutsche has just been implicated in almost everything now. I mean, you name it,
Everything,
right? If there's an
yeah.
area of fraud that a bank has been involved in over the last few years, sadly, Deutsche has had a hand in it. And I mean, at some point, although I don't know exactly how this will happen, but at some point, I suspect Deutsche Bank is going to be some combination of broken up into pieces and/or shut down. I just think BaFin's lost patience with Deutsche.
Yeah. All right. Next question from Andrew wants to know, do you believe precious metals will behave, or how do you believe they will behave if there is a some type of windfall profit tax decreed in the future? How will that affect demand, financial privacy, and the ability to trade precious metal for items of real value?
Yes. Now, sadly, of course, there are two things that are sure in life: death and taxes. And in a way, you can understand why, if governments finally see the writing on the wall and realize that they need to devalue versus real assets, and that implies far higher prices for gold and silver, you can see how they would seek to tax that windfall profit to help them out with their finances. I think it's definitely a strong probability, maybe not in all countries, but certainly in some countries, including probably the United States, that indeed some windfall tax is placed out there. But as with any tax, there's a point at which that tax will maximize the government's revenue, because if it's too high, the gold will just remain in private hoards. And if it's really, really tiny, they won't get much tax revenue. Now, I don't know exactly what the so-called Laffer curve for this sort of windfall tax would look like, but I suspect the number is actually surprisingly low. That is, if you really want people to part with their gold, because people can always hold out hope that the tax will be rescinded at some point, and a lot of wealthy people own the gold and will not need to liquidate it. I think that really the right number for something like that, and again, I'm not advocating this. I'm just saying, if I were a government bureaucrat and I was told to try to calculate the peak of the Laffer curve for a precious metals windfall tax, I'd probably put it no more than about 20%.
Yeah, that's an
So
interesting point.
don't Yeah, so don't get me wrong. I mean, it could well happen. But that's sort of what I would put it at. And to be honest, I mean, the tax on gold as it stands today, unless it's in an IRA, is that order of magnitude anyway, right? So in a way, the windfall tax in a way the windfall tax is already in place. Now that brings me to an important point, which is that gold is eligible in an IRA. However, in a standard IRA, it has to be gold as a security, such as through an ETF. The ETFs, according to many people, and I share this sympathy, are not necessarily as secure from a custodial chain point of view as actual physical allocated bullion. If you do want to own physical allocated bullion through an IRA, you must convert it or open a self-directed IRA, a SIDRA. So that you can do. And gold money is able to provide that. So that is something worth considering. If you put it in an IRA, it's certainly possible that if you safeguard your gold in an IRA, that the windfall tax, were it to come about, would not apply. Because IRAs are political, boy. You don't go after IRAs, right? That will, you'll get thrown out of office in a hurry if you advocate raiding people's IRAs. So there's strength in numbers. And for those who have not yet considered the possibility, I recommend you at least investigate your options for creating a self-directed IRA, allocating to physical bullion within that self-directed IRA. That may be the best way to protect yourself from a possible opportunistic windfall tax down the road.
That's a good point. Again, the idea of them cherry picking things within the umbrella of the IRA does seem unlikely. You're right.
Less likely, I think, yeah.
I had, and actually, I've got two questions left, and somebody actually sent one in that I accidentally deleted. So if there's somebody out there listening and think, "Hey, he didn't ask my question," that's just me being an idiot and fat fingering the trash can on here. All right, two questions left from Sanford. Want to get back to this idea of gold-backed currency or gold-backed trading notes. That's something that Jim Willie has talked about off and on, that the BRICS, China, Russia, whomever would float some type of gold-backed trade note instead of a direct currency. Is that the kind of cooperation that you're talking about?
Yes. So what you could have is you could sort of create this parallel currency, which was a note that could circulate in exchange for exports. So if you export, you could accumulate these notes, and these notes would be a claim on gold. So even though you wouldn't go on to a full gold standard, for external trade you would. And that's also something I speculate about in my book. That is, it's external trade where arguably the incentives are strongest for countries to be able to transact in a gold-backed currency. So even if you're not using it domestically, you're using it to settle external trade. And so these notes could be a useful way to do that. And as I mentioned earlier, if it's not just China, but a handful of other countries that seek to move away from the dollar and establish gold-based trade between themselves, that would be arguably the easiest way to do it, is to agree a convention for a note that doesn't have a specific national designation and
Right.
therefore can circulate internationally relatively frictionless, but could in theory be exchanged for physical gold in some agreed way under some agreed convention, and that would build the credibility in the system. That's definitely a possibility.
Don't know if this next question is in your wheelhouse or not, but Seamus is wondering that, we've had this latest surge forward in silver prices over the last week. Coincidentally timed with the recent announcement of about $75 million worth of silver being purchased by one of Eric Sprott's existing trusts. Seamus, just wondering if you think the two are related.
I think the two may well be related, because what Sprott did with this trust is kind of unprecedented. That is, just going out and literally raising new capital to purchase more silver in kind of one big go, rather than just sort of let the value of the trust sort of accumulate more pragmatically and incrementally. They could well be related. The fact is, however, I mean, let's step back from it for a moment. I mean, silver has every reason to go up here. Gold has every reason to go up. We're hearing rumors of emergency Fed meetings, or not rumors of emergency Fed meetings, as it were, on a regular basis. We're hearing rumors of severe distress in the European banking system, where, I mean, we're in this environment of zero or even negative interest rates. The real mystery, in my view, is how it was possible for gold and silver to fall as far as they did during that multi-year bear market that we had. I think it's behind us now, but and that we had some correction following the huge run-up in precious metals prices into 2011. That we had some correction doesn't surprise me, but the fact that the correction was, I guess, what, roughly 40% peak to trough or something like that. I mean, that to me, just the order of magnitude seemed large. And now of course we've seen a bounce, and the bounce is quite strong. But if you put it in its historical context, it really just kind of gets us back to within some range of the trend line that had been established prior to those spectacular years of 2009, 10, 11, and then the bear market. So I think really what's happening now, we're just reestablishing the secular uptrend following a particularly large multi-year correction, which was larger than I would have anticipated. So what the outlook for gold and silver, I think, is very strong in the near term. But I believe that, in fact, we're still part of the secular bull market, which has real legs. And again, to clear the imbalances that we've accumulated in the global economy, gold and silver prices are going to have to be an order of magnitude higher. We're talking sort of five digits for gold if you truly want to clear out the imbalances that have accumulated and allow sustainable global growth to kickstart again. You're going to have to
Right.
see a five-figure. You're going to have to see a five-figure gold price, and silver, you're going to have to see a three-figure silver price. And there's no other way, right? There's just no other way for the system to rebalance and deleverage and reallocate misallocated resources without those sorts of price movements for the precious metals. There's just no other way to do it.
And why is that, John? Can you kind of put that in English, and just a quick explanation as to why that's the case?
Yes, because the imbalances are themselves financed by dollars. Because the world is on a dollar-centric monetary system, all the imbalances, that is the accumulated trade deficits and the accumulated trade surpluses, those have to be financed, and they are overwhelmingly financed in dollars. Therefore, the way to rebalance is to do is you can either A, grow your way out through stimulus, which, as we can see, fails everywhere, because the balance sheet is just too leveraged, the global balance sheet, and the imbalances are just too large. So you can't grow your way out. Don't you think you would know by now if we could grow our way out of this? Don't you think all the stimulus that they've thrown at things, monetary, physical, etc. Look, if it were really possible to grow our way out, we'd be growing by now, damn it, and we're not, okay? We're not. And so the only other way to try and get yourself out of the mess you're in is to address the balance sheet as it is without trying to grow out of it and just rebalance it for the size that it is. That requires a devaluation of the imbalances, and that requires the dollar to fall in value versus real assets. Now, not only the dollar, maybe every currency has to decline versus real assets. And that's probably the only way out, is for most currencies to decline substantially, some simply to decline a bit less than others, but for all nominal values, currencies, bonds, to decline in value versus real assets. That clears the deck of the leverage, of the imbalances. That if you clear the deck, then you're able to grow again. Why? Because you don't have this massive balance sheet overhang that makes growing your way out impossible. That's what has to be done.
All right. I have one last question. And this is running. We're already 45 minutes into this, John, so I want to really thank you for spending so much time. And we may have to do this again soon, because even that last question leads to more questions. So we may have to double back to some of these.
Well, maybe my answer wasn't good enough.
No, it was tremendous. I'm just thinking, the first thing that comes to mind then is you're the regular guy doesn't know any of this stuff, and it's just dollars in your pocket and in your savings account. After this rebalancing, let's say you've got to reprice gold at $10,000 an ounce and do this rebalancing. How does that affect the regular guy that then goes to the grocery store the next day?
The problem is this. There's going to be this one-off wave of inflation that's going to come through. And it will be historic. It will be big. It may make the late 70s feel like price stability. I mean, really, it could be that bad. Now, it will be temporary, and it will come to an end. But what you want to do is you want to try and protect your accumulated wealth as best you can, so that your purchasing power with that wealth post wave of inflation is comparable to that pre wave of inflation. And this is where you need to beware both stocks and bonds, because bonds are expensive and they will be devalued along with the currencies as the currencies are devalued versus real assets. So you need to lighten up on bonds. The problem with equities, though, is that equities may rise in price to some extent with inflation, but as in the 1970s, they won't be able to keep up. Why? Because the valuations that are placed on stocks get crushed when you get big waves of inflation coming through, just as happened in the late 70s and early 80s. So even if the price of equities was rising in the late 70s, the PE ratios and other multiples were declining. Valuations were coming off very sharply. And then you get into the early 80s when PE ratios fall into the single digits. I mean, imagine that today. That would cut roughly two-thirds off the value of growth stocks, and value stocks would lose about one-third of their value. I mean, this is, you know, it's that order of magnitude. So what I would say is, obviously, and this is the best solution of all, of course, is if you want to hold some stocks and bonds, fine, but you must blend in a substantial position of precious metals to diversify that financial asset position and to prepare for this potentially large one-off wave of inflation rolling through. What's the right number? Well, if you take a long-term historical view, long-term historical analysis, even in good times, you get a diversification benefit from around 10 to 15% of a typical portfolio also allocated to gold and silver. So blending in 10 to 15% gold and silver is kind of a benchmark, as it were, for a well-diversified portfolio for both good times and bad. But if you're positioning specifically for bad times, you want to double that, basically. You really do. And I know that sounds like a huge number. I mean, for people to think, oh my God, am I really supposed to hold 30 to 40% of my portfolio in precious metals? Well, look at the 1970s, especially the late 70s, early 80s, and the answer is clear. Yes, you do. You absolutely do. And so the numbers are big. And most people, even people that think about gold a lot, think about silver a lot, they don't really get into that order of magnitude. But I can show you the numbers. And the right answer, it is that big a number. It is a big number. And of course, with bond yields at essentially zero, You could also argue that the that bonds should be reduced vis-a-vis both stocks and precious metals as this as we anticipate this wave of inflation rolling through. So you know that's kind of my practical advice. Accumulate that large position in gold and silver. Try to get it up to something that order of magnitude, 30 to 40% of your liquid net worth. Of course, if you own your house, great. If you want to own some other property, great. Property should hold its value reasonably well as the inflation comes through. So that you know, those are simple, practical things that people can do to protect themselves. But it's really about protecting yourself. It's not about this is not a get rich quick you know idea here.
Right.
That said, if you want to hold some miners, miners have done very well year to date. But boy, they're still cheap. So if you do want to hold some mining equities to add a bit of juice to all of this, by all means do so. Just be diversified about it, and don't try to just punt around in junior miners, but rather you know spread that mining position somewhat more broadly so that you get the diversification benefit of that position.
John, I tell you, I'm sitting here, and I'm sure most everybody listening, I'm shaking my head. I know you're right, and from a individual level, that's the exact right practical advice. But what really leaves me shaking my head and very concerned is what we've always talked about on a much larger scale, is that all the folks that are out there living paycheck to paycheck that are already stretched as thin as they could be, trying to just put food on the table or fund their kids' education or whatever. And yep. And now the world is going to enforce upon them this huge wave of inflation. And I, again, for folks listening, now you see how this all connects. When we have people on here that talk about, you know, fearful of social disorder, and that's a polite way of putting it, you can certainly see where this could all lead. John, I want to be respectful of your time. I think I better at this point just go right into the final four, if you don't mind, and you know, which is our typical way of wrapping up. Just some kind of four fun questions, just to
sure,
just to kind of send you out the door, let everybody get to know you a little bit better. So if you're ready, can I hit you with them?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
All right, my friend. You are, like I said, an American in London, grew up in California. So do you ever get a craving for In-N-Out Burger?
I absolutely do. I'll never forget my first trip to an In-N-Out Burger. It was somewhere in the greater LA area. It was like a religious experience, I have to say. You never forget your first In-N-Out.
That's a good way to put it. All right. Number two, you have a family though in London. I've got to ask you this. Have you ever taken the family down and ridden that big Ferris wheel down there along the river?
Yes, we have. And there are also some other rides now that have been put up along the river. They've got kind of a mini amusement park with a couple avant-garde, small but fun roller coasters. So it's actually a very nice place to go for a family day out. So yes, we have done that.
Give that a thumbs up, that eye thing?
Yeah, yes, because it's quite slow, so you really get to take in the sights. And you can also bring in food and drink. Some people have private parties. Occasionally, they hire one out for a private party, and it can be catered. And that's if you really want to push the boat out, as it were, that's a nice way to do it.
I suppose so. All right. I don't know if you have a vote in June, but if you were to guess right now, Brexit up or down?
All the momentum is with the pro-Brexit camp right now. I don't know what sort of tricks are going to be played by either side going into the actual vote. But as it stands now, Brexit is starting to climb ahead in the polls, much to the fright of the government, which say they're very much on the side of staying in the EU. But look, this is what it comes to. The fact is that people in this country do not feel that their government is as accountable as it should be, and they're blaming Brussels in part for that lack of accountability. And right or wrong, other factors equal, smaller government tends to be more accountable than a larger government. So getting rid of this layer imposed to some extent from Brussels is very, very appealing to people on all sides of the political spectrum, because anyone who believes that the government simply isn't accountable enough, regardless of the specific issue they're concerned about, it all goes back to the same place. You want to restore a smaller, more local government to this country. So that, I think, helps to explain why the Brexit vote is beginning to climb ahead in the polls.
And with the final question is the one that we typically roll out for folks is their final question. I hand you 1,200 Federal Reserve notes, or roughly 1,200 today. And you have the option to walk into a coin shop and buy yourself 1 ounce of gold or about 80 ounces of silver. Which are you going to choose?
I believe that the time horizon is very, very important here. It is possible that gold gets even more expensive than silver if we are going to roll another financial crisis here. It could happen. That said, looking through the crisis, let the wave of inflation come and go, let the banks fail, be reorganized, whatever's going to happen. If you look through it, silver will eventually re-rate back to somewhere in the 40 to 50 range, in my opinion. So, gold for the near term, silver for the longer term. I know it's kind of a BS answer, perhaps, but that is honestly the way I kind of see it.
Fair enough. Fair enough. All right, John. Hey, this has just been fabulous, and I do hope we can do it again soon. But on your way out, though, please tell everybody again the benefits of a Bitgold/gold money account.
Yes, look, we're the oldest, most respected and trusted global gold custodian. We operate completely independent of the banks. We have over 800,000 user signups now. We're offering payment services increasingly in countries around the world, starting in Canada, but we're rolling it out in the U.S. now and elsewhere. We're simply the most convenient, lowest cost, best customer service way to save and or, if you choose, to spend your physical allocated bullion. We believe we're part of the solution. The parallel financial infrastructure that we're building out will someday do a complete end run around essentially all core aspects of banking. But Rome wasn't built in a day. Some pieces of that ecosystem, that infrastructure, do already exist. There are a lot more that are coming, and we do hope that as we build out that infrastructure, we will take more and more business away from these, you know, dysfunctional banks who purport to have their interests aligned with their clients, but more and more people, including myself, simply do not see it that way anymore.
That's for sure. John, thank you so much. It's just been great, and very much appreciate all your time today, and hopefully we can do this again soon.
My pleasure, Craig. Thank you very much. Let's do it again.
Thanks to everybody for listening. We'll see you again next week.